but most everything today is a tap. Chief sponsor, of course, gets a chance to talk about it or who they sponsored it for. Give us an explanation, and there won't be much action going on because we're preparing for that next week to make sure we get, as I promised, a number of these on record. Let's start with HJM, Hospital Memorial 3, because we have, I think, Destiny Jensen close by. Let him talk about that real quick. He knew who he was. If we don't have any problems with this,
I mean, are you just, you have a kind of plan by area?
Yeah. I'll give you an indication. I was going to try to let you know what was going to happen. Did he escape real quick?
Yeah.
Okay, let's hold off here just a second. And, I didn't officially open it. We won't start on House Door Memorial 3. Let's start with, I think Wyatt was in the program for 38. Let's open on, I can see which one did you want to talk about.
3, and I'll make it very brief because I know your time is short and a lot of things to do. HGM 3, I'm bringing HGM 3 to you because and bringing it to you and urging your support for this memorial. The memorial is the result of the National Marine Fisheries Service's biological opinion in 1995. Part of that opinion is referred to as the bucket-for-bucket principle. And fundamentally, that bucket-for-bucket principle means that an irrigator or anyone else who withdraws water, new water from the Columbia River, must replace that water from an upstream water right before being allowed to withdraw water for their purposes. This opinion has had wide and detrimental effects on Oregon and on Oregonians, and especially on Oregonians in my particular section of the state. There's one major reason for my bringing this bill to your attention, and while it was the intent of the National Marine Fisheries Service to help protect and restore salmon, a goal that we would recommend to you that is very laudable, the opinion in our judgment is based upon completely ludicrous flow projection for the Columbia River. Given the assumptions that were made by the National Marine Fisheries Service for a target flow in the Columbia River, it needs to be noted that if there were no people in either Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, anywhere else, if there were no people, no dams on the river, no artificial man-made impediments in the river, In other words, we were back to a time pre-Columbus. The Columbia River would not reach the National Marine Fishery Service's projected goals, target goals, in more than eight out of the 10 years. Only 3 out of the 10 years might it meet those projected goals. I'd suggest that if salmon had need of this type of flow in the river in order to survive, we would not have a problem today. We would not have a problem, members of the committee, because we would not have any salmon. HGM3 requests the director of the National Marine Fishery Service discontinue the requirement of the basically bucket-for-bucket mitigation, and also requests the director to develop constructive standards to mitigate harm to species listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act in the Columbia and Snake River Basin. I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
But
thank you very much for your time and consideration, and at your work session I urge that you support this review. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to close the hearing on HGM3. We'll open a hearing on House Bill 3467. Representative Keene. Christina, do you have a copy of that, or shall we just start here?
Mr. Chairman, members, House Bill 3467 establishes 3-state underwater dive parks. I'm going to introduce shortly.
And if you just allow me some real quick questions, we've got some students here, and I'd like to know where they're from, so I can kind of introduce them. They're here listening to a committee and visiting today. Someone want to stand up and say what school you're from? Stand up.
Welcome,
very welcome. Any other school representatives? Well, welcome. Thank you so much. Okay, Representative King, all yours.
Sounds like a good school, and we should let them help decide the building. Thank you, Al King, State Representative of District 44, and I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to testify on House Bill 3467, the dive park bill. It came to my attention that Washington and California have a very large number of dive parks, and that Oregon has zero, and that it's I am very aware that people who pursue the scuba diving hobby, one, they're very enthusiastic about it, and two, I know that it's growing very fast. And three, they spend a lot of money doing it, and I think you're going to hear more about that. But I think this does open up an additional niche for tourism, particularly on the Oregon coast, but not exclusively there. There are freshwater locations as well. That we wanted to be open-ended and low-cost impact. We did not say that the park had to go any specific place. We wanted to make sure that this did not create any preserves, that when a dive park would be created, that the divers would not be taking, from that area. But if a fisherman was fishing in that place first, it's first come, first serve. As the dive flag goes up, it's common courtesy to not go fishing there or have another boat there as well. There will probably be some legislative fiscal involved, but it is the intent of myself as a proponent and of others that what we really want is the sign. We're not looking necessarily for the parking lot, the driveway, the Cadillac program. if the program is successful and economically carries its own weight, those things, you know, could come in time proven from success. We feel that if we put the sign there, they will come. And it came to my attention also that we're actually spending considerable amount of state dollars sending people who are learning to scuba dive outside of the state of Oregon because we don't have dive parks in which to do the qualifications that are necessary to legally become a certified diver. I have had conversations on the coast. I think you can see, you know, in terms of the support on the bill, that that this has very strong support, you know, among the coastal caucus. I think there are real concerns, you know, some of the local communities that they don't want to be told that they have to do something. I think once they see that that this occurs and something is successful, that there may be even more communities that would like to participate in that success. I could go on, but I think you've got a lot of bills to cover, so I'll be glad to stop and answer any questions about those.
Do the other ones want to speak, Chairman? Sure.
I've gone to Edmonds Underwater Dive Park up in Washington. Mm-hmm. I typically spend... Susan Hutchinson from Eugene, Oregon. I'm a diver, and I go through Edmonds Underwater Park in Washington because there's no park here. In one weekend, I see each day hundreds and hundreds of divers, and I know my husband and I typically spend from $400 to $500 or more each weekend on lodging and meals, rental equipment. That's a lot of money that could be saved in the state.
Morning, King. I'm at Woods, Oregon, and there's a lot of dealers, but this is a private concern. You might notice over here on the right wall, that's my dive equipment. That's all the stuff I take with me when I go diving. Plus, I got one more tank that I didn't bring in. The black suit is about $600. The tank, the BC, and the regulators that are on top of it. The tank is $150. The BC is $350. The regulator outfit is about $800. Okay, and I won't get into the little detail stuff because, like the little pink tank on the floor, that's $250. Okay. This is really, to me, an economic development bill, but also a sport bill. We do want to designate some underwater parks as amended, and you have amendments, I think, that would be required to have three dive parks by 2003. So we're not talking really any money in this biennium. We need to look at this issue. We need to go out to the community and see who wants a park. We don't want to go where the parks don't want it. And allow the Parks Department to make some rules and get some volunteers together. In the packet I gave you, there is a list of Oregon dive shops. Okay. There's also Central Puget Sound dive sites, a map. Okay. That's just Central. Okay. That's not all the other places. And then there's a map of the number one park anywhere probably is Edmonds Dive Park. And I've made probably 45 dives there, and I haven't even seen half the park yet. This park is a city park, not a state park. This park is also done all by volunteer efforts. The city doesn't spend money on this place. They get a little bit of money for the permit from night dives and stuff. The last page, park regulations for Edmonds. There's not very much above the water in Edmonds, but it is off in sight. So I would urge the committee to pass this bill. I would really urge the committee to try and have the Ways and Means subsequent referral rescinded because there isn't a lot of money here. I mean, if you really want a lot of bathrooms and garbage cans and stuff like that, you can spend all the money you want, but that's not what we want.
I understand that's what you were asking for.
That's basically it. I should have brought in a lot more people, but I didn't want to do it because of time.
That's on the committee.
You can look at my equipment.
That's in too.
Do you look down on North Worth?
Mr. Jim, Representative Taylor, actually, I look up to them because underneath them. So, yeah.
Other questions? In committee. Representative Merkley.
I gather the question over the amount of money that it would cost is because it's relatively undefined what establishing a park means, and that you're primarily interested in pennies. Would you consider it a friendly amendment to clarify what it was you were asking for in establishing parks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, that's fine with us as long as we get some parks. There's no real definition in here of where the parks are going to go, and that's on purpose. The advisory committee really should be the one that goes out and looks where people want to have parks. I don't know exactly how to put that into words, maybe, because that was our intent. We go out and look, where should we have a park, and then have Parks Department go out and designate those parks in the normal process. About 5 years ago, I was president of a Salem dive club called Bottom Dwellers, and we asked Parks to come in. They did come in and said, well, we're working on that. Well, it's 1999. We're still working on it. We just want them to step forward and get it done, get some signage up, and let the people of the world know about it. Oregon has a great dive spot. They really do. I've dived with petrified forest, just standing upright in the lake. I've dived in rivers. I've dived offshore. There are some great places. My own personal opinion, the best dive spot in Oregon could be the tank where Keiko was. Always there. You can have night diving. Water's always calm. Friends can come and watch you dive. I mean, there's some great
places. They have other bills, Mr. King.
Okay. Another question?
I would like to close in that the Parks Department already has the ability to create dive parks. So I think that they would appreciate, you know, this bill in terms of giving them, you know, direction and mandate. And we are missing an industry. It's about time to do that.
Representative King, that just reminds you of a good multiple natural resource and multiple use bill.
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Jim Lockwood. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Jim Lockwood from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. This is a bill that is basically supportive of the direction we were working on, and as you've heard, we were not moving too quickly, but it is something that we have no particular trouble with. As you know, the more you work with an advisory committee around the state and check things out, it does take some resources, but if there's ever been a group I've worked with that has been over backwards to say we don't want the Cadillac, we just want the basics, this has been the group. So the one thing, Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, you said something about a friendly amendment, and because of the noise over there, I didn't hear what you proposed. The amendment that has been suggested by the proponents of the bill to change the deadline date out to 2003, of course, spreads out the cost over time and gives us time to acquire or make good property or make agreements, but I didn't hear Representative Merkley suggest it.
Mr. Chair, I understood in prior conversations about this that the proponents are looking primarily for signage to popularize and inform people about opportunities to dive, and that the Park Bureau is perhaps looking at more building infrastructure to be more expensive, and it wasn't necessarily the intent of the movers of the bill to build expensive infrastructure. And it just sounds like there's a little bit of I guess my question is it clear in your mind what the proponents are asking for when they're asking for dive parks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, I would say it's generally clear. As you can imagine, it depends on if it's a freshwater spot or salt. There's variations depending on where it is. Also, in some cases, we may be required to make something ADA accessible, or we have those kinds of requirements, or where we're drafting, there's a piece in there that says regarding the legal liability, well, of course, we go to the Department of Justice and pay so much an hour for that, and it depends on how much legal work there is. So there's always those unknowns. But I think the spirit of their wanting to keep it simple is really something we can go on, because they, from the beginning, said they wanted the basics, and we can just start with that and go from there. I don't know that we could do anything right now to really peg the cost, to really know what it is. We'll be.
Mr. Chair. I believe I heard Representative King say that the Parks Department already had the authority to do dive parks. Is that correct?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, or Representative Morgan. That is correct. In their bill, there is some language on the liability. To some extent, this is I can't speak for them, but I think I get the sense that they'd like you to send us a message that this is seen as valuable by the legislature. One of the issues for us is that the legislature sends bills like this toward the Parks Department is that if we have too many bills that are free that don't have a cost, pretty soon, you know, a penny here and a penny there, and it's real money to us as an agency. And so we get a little concerned about very many bills coming that don't have any financial resources with them, but their sense is that they'd really like this to be acknowledged as one of the formal steps in the process of moving forward. And we don't feel any need to fight that or have a concern about that.
May I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
I guess what I'm confused about is if you already have the ability to establish dive parks, why haven't you done it, or what difference is this bill going to make?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Number one is we actually do have a draft master plan over in the Ukraine Bay area that has kind of coming forward. It's not there yet with agreements, but a proposal for a dive park. We have some suggestions on other areas. We really had best work with the advisory body that's brought forth in this bill if this is the way we go, so that we don't get too far out in front of the industry. We've had input over the years, so we've been working that direction. I think a bill gives it a little bit more weight behind it, makes it a little bit more of a priority. And there was one other thought of loss in there. I can't recall. I'm sorry, I lost the other.
May I ask one more?
Yeah.
Do you have already the authority to establish an advisory committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we have a number of advisory committees that are set in statute, and then, of course, we get input from either groups that exist, whether it be a group like the Sierra Club and the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, and so on, existing groups that are not formally established all the time. And so in something like this, we would naturally do that anyway. So in a sense, like to get your drift, we don't really have to have legislation, that's for sure. We were just not wanting to oppose it because it's the direction we're going anyway. And so we've been working with the representative and the interest groups here to try to see, just to keep it simple and clean.
I think what would clarify things for the department, though, as I understand it, is certainly as a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and they will battle out the dollars and numbers and significance of that there.
Mm-hmm.
And that will clean up maybe some of our opportunities here.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, and I didn't get your name written down.
Mr. Chair, representing now is Jim Lockwood.
Jim, I was just wondering if it would help you to get your bill through if you clarified how simple, rather than going from past experience to, maybe putting in a bridge and they add the bike trails and they add this and they add that, and pretty soon the expense is so big and that they're writing down on paper the proposal that you never get your chance to get your underwater park. Would it be helpful if you put, if you had it printed up exactly what you have in mind and how simple it is, to keep them from, in their thinking, making the planning too big and too expensive and unattainable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Janella, I am the them that they're afraid of making it too complicated. So I think I hear you. And also, any of us that work in government know how complicated anything can get. So they've sensitized us. We're listening, and that's why I think maybe this project will be a test of how simple can we keep it, or can we try. I'm watching myself as I go forward.
Well, let's let Ways and Means battle it out here, obviously. if we get the other members here, I will move the bill. The chair would like to do that. We'll wait for them, and I'll close the hearing on 3476.
Thank you.
We have some other members here. Representative Byer is here. Let's open the hearing on 2979. Welcome, Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. Here today to introduce House Bill 2979 to you. Along with the bill, there should be a Dashwood Amendment, hopefully it's in your packet.
I actually have one here, pretty close.
Okay. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2979 creates an education reserve fund. What it does is ask the Division of State Lands to complete a survey that they've been asked to do many times. They haven't, to the best of my knowledge, completed it yet. And with the money that is received above and beyond from the leases they currently have, the proceeds from that money would go into a new account that's created. We call them the Education Reserve Fund. The money would be continually appropriated into that account, and at a time, not this session, but after that money, that account has a significant amount of money into it, we would then figure out a way to spend that money for education. My vision is that would be a job of one of the future legislators, not this session. To speak more specific to the bill, I'd like to introduce Mr. Ross Day. He's here with me. He's the one who's been working with the proponents of this bill and on the specifics. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Members of me, Ross Day, for Representative Roger Byer. And I promise Representative Atkinson I keep this real short and sweet, so I'll do the best I can. I came about the problem, if you can want to call it that, regarding the lease rate system last August when I was working at a law firm, and clients came in who were having problems with the promulgation of rules by the Division of State Land and State Land Board for they're developing a new system for calculating lease rates, and I'm sure the Division of State Lands will be up here to try to explain a fairly complicated system to you. So when I saw what was going on, I thought to myself, there's got to be an easier way of doing this, and I talked with the clients, and they had proposed several times what appeared to me to be a much simpler plan, and that's what the Dashwood amendments are supposed to be. Now, part of the problem is with the way the lease rates, the waterway leasing program is set up, and that is that right now the state land board is allowed to set, basically set the lease rates. There is a minimum in the statute, not a maximum, at which those lease rates can be set. I talked with the Division of State Lands this morning. They do actually have an inventory of all submerged and submersible land. However, they do not have everyone who, under current law, should be under a lease. They do not have those people, those users of our submerged and submersible land under lease. Their estimates today range from 100 to upwards of 2,000 users of submerged and submersible lands who are not currently under lease. There's a problem in the statutes, and that is that the state land board is allowed to create exemptions for certain uses as they see fit. And those are people who should be leasing property or should be under a lease agreement with the state but aren't. And that's something we'll have to fix in perhaps Dash-2 amendment. That's pretty much it. Be happy to answer any questions. Do you have any
questions from the committee?
Thank you. I was a little troubled by the change from the minimum to the maximum. Could you explain that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, the original draft of House Bill 2979 was not drafted correctly, I guess is the easy way of saying it. It was supposed to include a maximum, take out the minimum language. Right now, in current statute, there's simply a floor. The Division of State Land Board, is not allowed to go below a certain rate, meaning it can go, you know, as high as they see fit. The idea of inserting the substituting minimum with the maximum language and then the rate schedule in the Dash 1 amendment is to provide some uniformity and some equity in the current submerged commercial land lease rate structure in the state of Oregon.
If I might continue, Mr. Chair. Is the intent of your legislation that we as a legislature will set into statute what the division currently does by rule?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, when you say by rule, you mean setting the lease rates, correct? That is, that's what the Dash 1 amendments would do.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair. So you set a ceiling on the, at the rate that the use classification that is currently at the highest, you set that ceiling there. And it does quite dramatically change for some other classifications. But is it your intent to oppose? When I read the minimum, I thought if they're going to be charged a minimum of 14, you know, that'll really up the log graph. But that's not your intent, as I understand it now. It's to put a ceiling on it, not a minimum, right?
Mr. Chair, if I'm correct, it's a ceiling, not a floor.
Other questions? Okay, well, that's in Meserly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ken Meserly. I'm a state representative for District 48. My district goes from the outskirts of Coos Bay and the east side of Coos Bay to the California border. So my district does include a lot of all types of water bodies from bays, ocean, lakes, and rivers. I'm here today not to talk about the details of this amendment, which I just recently observed, but to just talk to you about the need for legislation that would level the playing field and make it equal, not only from one part of the state to another, but adjacent property owners. I'm also urging you to consider legislation that would insist on a survey so that we're looking at all the property owners in the state and we know that we're covering all the bases. In districts such as mine, as well as up and down the coast, it's important that we get this thing figured out. I'm served for 10 years on the Port of Banding Commission, and so I'm very familiar with the struggles that businesses close to waterways have. It's very costly to maintain their properties, and several of them have literally gone out of business. I'm also a director of a bank in Newport, and in that capacity I've had some exposure to what some of those people in that community are going through in dealing with their waterfront properties. So it's an issue that I simply want to urge you to try to come to some resolution with, and I thank you for looking at this issue and reviewing this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Any other questions from the committee?
Currently, the lease money from the submerged land goes to the common school fund, as I understand it. So how would this be different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, this bill, what it describes is that current funds from the lease of properties would not change. Any new leases that are made and the funds coming in from those new leases as a result of this legislation will go into a new account, which would be called the Education Reserve Fund. And that fund would just continue to grow for at least the next 2 years or until they start making these leases until it gets there. And then it would be a pot of money set aside for future legislators to decide how best to distribute.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, there is another probable amendment we discovered this morning we probably need for the bill, and I apologize. I thought we had this ready to go, so it would be amendments we would need, and we could move it today, but I think we probably will. We do have a language, but it's not an LC form, so we can give that to the committee.
That would be fine. I appreciate that. We'll let those be drawn up. I'll schedule it for next week to finish on, but I can give state lands. I think we have a few people here, too, that did want to speak on this, especially for it. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And would John Early come forward? Standing in for Paul Clinton. Did you get a copy of the First Amendment here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have copies of the amendments. I think I can find them someplace in my pile if we need to refer to them. For the record, my name is John Lilly. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands, and appreciate the opportunity to be before you today on this matter. We're distributing not only the testimony that has been prepared on the bill, but also a packet of information that represents about 3 years of work on this very issue. It is voluminous, let me tell you.
I appreciate that. I needed something to do this weekend.
We're hoping that the weather will be good enough to kind of work outside.
I didn't mean anything else,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill represents, I think, two distinct policy issues for the legislature to consider. First, it redirects the waterway leasing revenue previously deposited in the Common School Fund to a new education reserve fund. And second, it establishes in law the annual lease rates for commercial and private use publicly owned submerged and submersible lands. In the packet that you've received, there is a document that lists all the publicly owned submerged and submersible lands in the state. There is also a document that explains the history of the division and the state of Oregon's management of those lands over the 140 years since Oregon entered the Union. And there are a few other items as well, including a report from a task force that was commissioned by the State Land Board in 1996 to review these very issues relative to the management of the waterway leasing program and rate making. At this time, the division cannot support HB 2979 either in its original version, as you've seen today, or with the proposed amendments. Both of these would represent a significant departure from current policy and create substantial investment and operating inefficiencies, as well as to serve to widen the existing inequities in the waterway lease rates. The bill is introduced could have produced about $6.5 million more per year from the lessees than the current rates. Currently, we are able to generate from the current lessees, the current lease rates, about $1 million a year. And some of the members of this committee serve on our Ways and Means Committee and have heard our presentation about the revenues and statutory revenues and constitutional revenues and how we account for those in the division's budget. Almost 50% of that $6.5 million increase would come from log graft lessees. These are folks, primarily timber companies and towboat companies that use large water surface areas up and down the coast in the Columbia River to store logs for purpose of transport as well as waiting to go to the mills. One of these lessees would have seen their annual rent increase from $7,200 to over $215,000 per year. In our opinion, this is an increase that they couldn't bear and is out of line with the basic value of the leasehold, which is the value of the submerged and submersible land that we look to in order to set the rate, the contributory value of the land in the lease. On the other hand, the -1 amendments would cut some existing lease rates by 85%. We believe this would create a significant inequity between the high-value urban locations of some of our lessees and lower-value rural locations by imposing a kind of one-size-fits-all approach. In other words, you ought to pay the same for your house in Klamath Falls as you pay in downtown Portland. We don't think that's the correct approach when you're dealing with real estate, since we've been told that location is what drives the market. And we fear that this would substantially undercut private sector landlords who are marketing competing upland sites for facilities such as restaurant, retail stores, and warehouses. For the past 3 years, the board and the division have worked with a lot of folks to establish new rates and to establish a new rate-making methodology, as well as to establish a new way of doing business on the waterways relative to the leasing program. We've held over 30 public meetings and work sessions and public hearings, and most recently we held two public hearings just last month on this issue. Early on in the process, the board appointed a task force, and some of those task force members are in this room, and they will speak to you today. The board has frozen the lease rates during this 2.5-year review process, and the division is now preparing to present its final recommendations to the board in June. However, some lessees still find that this matter is controversial, and hence that's why we believe the issue is before you today. In a nutshell, some lessees would like to establish a use-based flat rate system that's basically the Dash 1 amendment, that would result in, no matter where your facility was located, if it was of a marina type, it would be the same price. It wouldn't make any difference if it was on Klamath Lake, in Charleston at the Port of Coos Bay, or in downtown Portland. The proposed use rate system would give some waterway businesses a clear economic advantage over non-waterfront businesses because their lease rates would likely be far below market. And as an example, a popular downtown Portland floating restaurant would make a total lease payment of $90 a month. We think that is kind of out of line when one considers that probably restaurants that are off the water that don't have the amenities that facility does and no doubt pay a lot more. In fact, if any of you rent parking places in downtown Portland, I suspect that $90 a month is a pretty good deal if you can find parking at that rate. On the other hand, the division has been evaluating a choice model, which we think allows lessees to pick from at least two different approaches in calculating their rates for like a marina. And the method adjusts to the lessee's location, their local business condition, and the seasonal use while establishing a maximum payment that would be derived. The lessee simply chooses which rate results in the lease cost for them. The choice method basically embodies the same waterway real estate management practices and logic and principles that have been used in the other western states and in British Columbia. And in some cases, Oregon's waterway lease rates, including the choice model, are more generous to the lessees than in our neighboring states. And for example, I cite a single floating home in a floating home community in Portland, currently under the choice model, would pay about $14 a month for a 2,500 square foot slip. But if that same facility were located in a new, that same home were located in a newly constructed floating home community across the Columbia River in Vancouver, they would pay the state of Washington $114 a month. So some differences in approach. When we compared the two different rate making approaches, the choice model versus the user or the use flat rate, more of the current lessees get a reduction in their rates than under the use-based flat rate. The proposed annual lease revenue for the use-based flat rate is about $50,000 more than the choice models. But we didn't set out in this process of rate making to necessarily increase the revenue derived from waterway leasing. What we were trying to do was resolve the inequities that the task force, the land board, and the division felt were existing in the current rate system. Both of the methods would result in $90,000 to $130,000 more over the current revenue, and we would use those dollars, according to my director. He says he would direct those to waterway inventory and improvement efforts, similar to what are contemplated in 2979, and which we're currently in the middle of doing. The division has been involved with waterway leasing since 1909. The revenues from these sources have always been deposited in the common school fund. their use for waterway management programs, and since 1968 have been included with other revenues in the Common School Fund principal. And the investment proceeds from the Common School Fund principal go to, are distributed twice annually to the K-12 schools in our state. There are about 387 leases covering 30 different waterways in the state, the Columbia, the Willamette, Coos Bay, you know, the Astoria area is where the majority of those leases are, but they primarily occur within the tidally influenced waterway reaches of our state. Given the complexities of the waterway lease administration, the legislature has historically relied upon the state land board to exercise its sound judgment in establishing these rules and rates. This reliance has not been misplaced, and we believe it both appropriate and necessary to continue the approach. As such, we strongly urge the committee to reject the proposals contained in this bill, and we are more than willing to sit down and provide the committee with a full briefing on our three-year effort to establish new rates, new rules, and a new program emphasis for the land board's waterway leasing program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be more than happy to ask
questions from the committee. Representative Morgan.
Have you inventoried the submersible lands that are owned by the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, we have. But I think the issue is not just whether we know where the publicly owned waterways are in the state. One of the documents I passed out to you lists the reaches of the waterways that are subject to public ownership. The real heart of the question is, though, the inventory as it relates to structures and improvements on these publicly owned waterways and whether or not they've been placed there under appropriately authorized by the Division of State Lands and the State Land Board. Directly to that question, the Division, as a result of urging by the task force, has undertaken quite an in-depth inventory of structures and improvements on these most developed waterways in the state that are under public ownership. Now, we haven't completed a complete refinement of that inventory, but we know where the structures are, and we're in the process of classifying them, contacting the upland property owners when we determine that they're subject to authorization in order to bring them into authorization.
May I ask one?
Yes.
So how many leaseholders currently do you have in your system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, there's about 387 individual leases that we currently have for waterway users.
And there may have one more. How many do you think are left yet to be, how many are left to be inventoried and placed under lease?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, the question is how many are out there that are without authorization and need to be brought under lease. My guess under the current regulations of the board are there somewhere between 50 and 100 leases yet to acquire. Now, on the other hand, this last April, the board established a new program to require that non-commercial private docks and boathouses that are under 2,500 square feet in size be registered with the division. We've begun that project. We now have somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 registrations. It is those structures that many of us see as we travel around the state. There are the private residential boat docks around the coastal lakes. There are the boathouses that front people's property on the Willamette River. Those are non-commercial structures. The 1991 legislature authorized us, the division, the opportunity to place certain structures that are exempt from these under a registration. And that's what we're doing.
May I ask another question? If you have 200 to 300 of them done, do you know how many there are of those altogether?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we estimate that there could be as many as 2,000 of those types of structures on the publicly owned waterways of the state. Now, it's important to note here that in 1991, the law was changed, and it changed the exemption qualifications for leases. And furthermore, the registration requirement for non-leasable structures didn't exist. So there was a class, and there still remain a class of structures that are out on our waterways that the law does not require to be authorized by the state of Oregon. And those types of structures are wharfs, navigation aids, temporary log booms, transient facilities of one kind or another, public facilities.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, John. We have several who have traveled farther than 100 miles. We'll bring those up. Bill Gavikos and John England. John England.
Mr. Chairman, I lost my composure listening to Mr. Lilly. So if I'm out of order, this is my first experience in something like this. I'll read my prepared statement. It'll be easier as it's been prepared. And I'd like to ask a few questions or make a few comments.
Please start out just by identifying yourself.
My name is Bill Beckles. I reside at 3444 Northeast 35th Avenue in Portland. I own a small marina and a recreational boat brokerage on the Columbia River. I've been involved in the marine business since 1954. The boat business in Oregon is primarily made up of small mom-and-pop operations like mine. These small businesses provide most of the recreational services and opportunities for people to enjoy the water. Two things have stood out based on my 45 years of experience in the business. Recreational boating is directly tied to the economy. When there's a downward shift in the economy, our business is one of the first to suffer. My costs do not go down during the hard times, and I've seen many of the small businesses fail as a result. The rate increases proposed by the DFL have not adequately taken into consideration the access we provide to the public, and even the choices offered do not adequately take into consideration the ups and downs of the boat business. When you look into it as I have, it does not provide a reasonable choice for all, my choice to stay in business or not. The boat business is one of the most regulated business there is. My marina suffered damage during the flood of 1996. It took me almost 2 years to repair the damage, going through all of the red tape. It will take many more years to pay for it. In fact, I have to take out a 30-year note to pay for it. I don't think the DSL has any idea at all that this costs the money to get through, and it's confusing. I've been wanting to put in a pump station as part of my flood repair and have been working with the Marine Board for grants to help me with it as a service to local boaters. Whatever it is, piling, replacement, or pump out stations, by the time you get through the Army Corps of Engineers, the state, the city, you wonder why you even got into it. I have attended almost all of the meetings of the task force, the public hearings, and land board meetings over the past 3 years, and do not understand why DSL does not listen to us. The proposed rates are too high, the new rules are too complicated, confusing, and don't make sense. The new lease form is ridiculous. If they proposed a lease form like this to my tenants, they would laugh at me and they would be leaving. The DSL has no competition. It is their way or else. If I ran my business like they do, I wouldn't have a business. Their choice is no choice at all. Please support this bill. The rates are probably too high, but it's better than what the DSL is proposing. There are two other letters I brought in, people who could not make it, from Mr. Bill Montgomery, and I'll leave those with the young lady, and then also Jan Hamer, who's also the past president of the Waterfront Owners and Operators. My only quick comments, there's notes scratched down here. The booklet you got from the DSL was quite small. I probably couldn't carry everything I've accumulated in the last 3.5 years. So yours is going to be easy compared to ours. They talk about log grass. Well, we all know log grass are going away. So it's just a diminishing group of people. They're putting on land, and that's what's the economical thing to do. The flat rate is very simple, and it would not require any more personnel and probably require less personnel to use the flat rate. The frozen part that they talked about is fine, except for my friend down the coast here who's paying probably, well, I don't know, John. Anyway, these people down there pay probably half of the budget of the DSL, and they're probably amounts to about, I don't know, maybe 13%. So the freezing didn't help him at all. I've been in the retail business such a long time that when they start talking about what they do in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Puget Sound, Canada. Why they waste your time doing this, ours is a very unique marketplace, and you can't give me the Puget Sound comparison or San Francisco or anything that happened in Los Angeles. I mean, this is, we all know what the state is. It's a small economy, and, the population is a couple million people. So now we're talking about, what they do someplace else. It doesn't wash. They didn't tell you about giving the private docks away. They took $40,000 out of their budget by putting the private docks on a different lease-type situation, or they call it a permit. I don't know what did it, but they did it. And they took a land board, and they passed it. And also, the non-trust lands that we're talking about, which I'm involved in, is what their budget is. It's about $1 million. There seems to be a lot of leases out there that nobody's discussed yet, and there'll be a lot of money, and we feel it should go to the Common School Fund. Their $1 million budget has functioned in the past. It's likely to function in the future. Thank you very much.
My name is John England. I live in Astoria. Have a marine supply business built over submerged land. Been a leasee of the state since its existence some 25 years ago. I suppose this, to understand all these lease rates, all the different types of leases, we could sit here for days. But it's very, very simple. You have two types. You have floating leases, and you have leases where there is a structure built on it. Floating leases over these 25 years have been kept on a flat rate. Right now, floating leases from which one is mortgages, houseboats, that type. The other floating lease is log graph. So there's two types of floating leases. Log graph right now are paying 0.0044, I think, 5 a square foot. Mortgages go from houseboats or whatever that type of go from 0.008 maybe up to 1.5 cents, maybe right in that area. That's what they're paying, and they have been left on that rate. Very important to understand. Please split this out. Then you have the other one where we have built structures over your leased land. There we don't operate on a flat rate. We go to the upland value, which is called the extension of upland value, or that is done at a 6% rate. So we go to the land adjacent to us and say that works out. You take the square footage of the land, divide it what the assessor says it's worth, and then you take 6% of that square foot, and then you apply that to the land. So if we had $5 a square foot for the upland, we would go 0.6 into the $5, so you would pay 30 cents a square foot. That's how the upland is done. Now, the upland leases today, or the 6% upland leases, what we're talking about, are 6% of the total lease area, only 6% of the total lease, and only are 6% of the leases. Yet we are paying 56% of the total revenue. Now, how does that happen? Well, ever since this was adopted, this was the law, and I'm not blaming the division, but the county assessor is dictating what we pay. 25 years ago, your piece of property was at this level. Today, I guarantee it's up here. And every time the county assessor came to our town, and he went along the waterfront to the adjacent, and he triggered a raise on the restaurant across the street or the hardware store or something, it triggered the value increase per square foot on the waterfront. That's how we got to this level, way up here, and yet we are this much of the leases. On the second page of your handout, you will see that it's the division's rate of what they're paying. It shows you how many acres each type of lease he has and what they contribute. So the county assessor is the one that's taking care of, is doing the 6%. We think that's totally, totally unfair. I'm from Astoria. If you look at the waterfront of Astoria, who is at my piece, I have a piece about 12 feet wide between the railroad track and the division's land. You leave our place and start down through the center of Astoria, the upland owner is a railroad track who is exempt. Who's the next one? Could be the hardware store, could be a restaurant, it could be several businesses facing the other way that have absolutely nothing to do with the waterfront. And yet, those people on the waterfront are being calculated at the rate of the square footage in that hardware store. Take a look at Newport. What's the upland of the bayfront of Newport? It's Bay Boulevard. So you go across the street of Bay Boulevard, and there's where you calculate your square footage. And it has nothing to do with what's going on the waterfront in many, many cases. Before you, I have a letter from the city of Astoria. And I will not read it to you. I hope you will read it. It was addressed to the governor from our mayor and the city council, and if you read that, I think you'll get a gist of what I'm trying to say. The flat rate, which we have calculated and worked on, is something to behold in that a very important thing happened. The governor selected a task force to go and look into this matter from all walks of life, including state agencies, and this is where this group is coming out of. All of a sudden, to become very, very aware what the very thing that was said is, the lease rate that we're under is absurd. It's out of date. It doesn't do a darn thing. We leaseholders, including Bill in Portland, who I knew a little bit and summoned back yet to testify, sat there in awe when it was dismissed, and we didn't really get to work on it. We have spent 2.5 to 3 years individually traveling with each other. And you have the metropolitan area, the yacht club, the working waterfront, us on the coast working, are all joined together, and we have some real knockdown dragouts of who's going to pay what. They will agree we're paying too high, but they don't necessarily want to raise their rates either. And we sat down and really did some hard knocking, and I have to tell you, my hats are off to them, because the metropolitan area could have left us on the coast in the lurch, and we were not politically strong enough to do anything about it. But they have stayed by us, and we have come up with that flat rate system that creates more money than the existing one without the new leases being added in, and we think it's fair and just. I start getting all wound up.
Well, I got a couple others I want to
Okay, fine.
Go over to. And
thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate your input here. Looks like we've got some more work to do here. Okay. We've got Representative Shirley here. I know wants to open on his. So let's close the hearing on House Bill 2979 right at the moment. I'll open on House Bill 3571. And 35, that's open on House Bill 3599.
They're separate bills.
Okay, I know. So we can open on both.
Two bills.
And I'm not sure, but...
We need to get that one.
Two bills from my little district. What county was that?
Yeah. Polk?
Benton.
Benton,
no. Mm. So now you want to bring it back on the side of us?
Now we want to move the river.
Or move the mountain range, you know, too.
Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. 3571 is the easiest, and I think I'm the only one signed up to testify on that. It amends ORS 215.213 by modifying the definition of community centers for what is allowed in an exclusive farm use zone. There's a little history to this. If you look on page 9 of the bill,
and then you also have some dash one amendments that go with that. You see that parks, playgrounds, community centers owned and under current law and operated by a governmental agency or a nonprofit community organization are allowed uses in a farm use zone. With the dash one amendments, this bill would amend that section of the statute to say that the community centers would be for the local or regional residents of the rural community. It narrows the definition of community center. And I'll tell you how this came about. I have in my district a little community called Wren, which is about 5 miles west of Philomath. And it's a quiet, peaceful area. Project Vote Smart, as you may know, has been headquartered in Corvallis, happened to own some acres out in Wren in the EFU zone and decided that they would like to build a library and conference center for their Project Vote Smart purposes. They bring in interns from around the world and around the country to volunteer to do all their Project Vote Smart work. And they thought things were getting kind of tight in downtown Corvallis, where I guess their offices were. And so they decided they wanted to build a library and conference center that would also serve as basically a dormitory or a place to live for their volunteers that come in. And they were going to build this out in the Wren community on EFU land. The community resisted the, and one of the ways they were citing it as a community center. Well, that worked well, except when it became apparent that the community wasn't going to get to use the center. It was going to be used by Project Vote Smart and was not going to be operated for the benefit of the Wren community or any other local residents for that matter, except for the folks that they might happen to bring in to live there. But nevertheless, the application went before the Benton County Planning Commission, which approved it. And they approved it on the argument and the understanding that the community center, they looked at it as something operated by Project Vote Smart as a community organization in the context of a larger national or global community of interest. And so that broad definition of community center all of a sudden gave the Benton County Planning Commission the green light to go ahead and approve this dormitory library conference center for the essentially the exclusive use of Project Vote Smart under this community center rubric. At that point, my office intervened in the appeal to the Benton County Commissioners, which, and the commissioners ultimately overturned the Planning Commission and denied the application. And as a postscript, I understand that Project Vote Smart is moving out of state. So this bill is a follow-up to that episode at the request of the Wren community, but it does highlight, I think, an ambiguity that opened up a potentially wide loophole in this community center provision in EFU zone property. So this this, as amended with the dash one amendments, would provide that the permitted community centers would those being operated for the benefit of the residents of the local rural community. Much more, I think, what people had in mind in the way of the kind of rural community centers you see around in Grange Halls and things like that. Anyway, that is the purpose of this bill. I think I distributed some written testimony, 1,000 friends. They said that if it looked like this bill was starting to have trouble, that they would oppose it. if we needed them to do that, but they actually think this is a fine bill, and let the record reflect this is the first time that 1,000 friends has liked the bill that I've had before your committee. So I'm happy to be signing with them. I think Tom Novick is here if you wanted to hear from him, but that's all I have to offer on this.
No, I only have DLCD if needed.
Oh, that's right. Do a DLCD MC, Ron Eber. Yeah, Ron Eber.
I think you did a good job, Rick, shortly. Questions for the crew.
Now, REN, that's an unincorporated?
REN is unincorporated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess if you could get 1,000 friends to change their position, that would give me more comfort.
Okay. They're opposed. Any questions?
They're going to count this one.
This would be two in a row, and that would be bad.
I know. It's all lazy.
All right. Anyone else out there really want to speak on this one? Okay. If there isn't, we'll be hearing an open work session on House Bill 4571.
Mr. Chair?
Let's move to
I move House Bill 3. I'm sorry, move the dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3571.
Representative Kapoy moves dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3571. Do we have any further discussion? Hearing none. Do we have any opposition? Hearing none. So
move. Mr. Chair?
Representative Kapoy.
I move House Bill 3571 as amended to the floor of the DCAS designation.
Representative Kapoy moves House Bill 3571 to the floor as amended for due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Cruz?
Aye.
Representative
Mackinson?
Aye. Representative
Bevel?
Excuse.
Representative
Vera? Aye. Representative Corey?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Taylor?
Aye.
Chair Watts?
Aye. And right number of votes, House Bill 3571, as amended, passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for hearing. Thank you very much. Representative Chevrolet, would you like to carry that? All right. Thank you very much. Okay.
Chair, I don't want to say it next one because lawyers talk too long on the floor.
And besides, I don't understand it.
Bob, I'm not sure yet.
We open a hearing on House Bill 3599.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Wayne Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. This comes to you from another part of Benton County, south of Corvallis, but it affects agriculture in the Willamette Valley in a very significant way. Constituents of mine, the Vinnells, run one of the finest grass seed farms in the valley. And having distributed to you a letter that they received, I will say from out of the blue, from the Division of State Lands, you can take a look at that. But and then attached to that, behind that, is a response from the Vinnells that... the response to the letter. What I'd like you to do in the packet, if you would, please turn back to this little page. It says History, Benton County, Oregon. If you see on there, there's a publication date of 1885, and two pages beyond that is this nice little picture that is of the what is now the Vinnell Farm. This is a farm that has been continuously farmed for 114 years at least. And so you can imagine their surprise in December of 1997 when they received a letter from the Division of State Lands informing them that the work that they were doing, repairing tiling in one of their fields, constituted a prohibited work in wetlands. And so they received, with this letter in December of 1997, a cease and desist order because they were, was it repairing or was it replacing? It was existing tiling anyway. Here was the field, the same field that had been farmed in 1885 and continuously ever since. They found, to their surprise, now constituted wetlands, and they were being ordered to stop any work repairing or replacing the tiling. As you know, the grass seed industry over the past decade and more has moved away from the field burning technology. And
because of that, requires a higher degree of maintenance in the field, and drainage is part of that. So this affects, potentially, the action the Division of State Lands took against the Vanels, affects not only them, but every other farmer that farms ground in the valley that has enough water on it during the wet months of the winter to constitute it as wetlands, even though it may have been in continuous production and farmed continuously, in this case, for the past 114 years. This bill clarifies the activities that are allowed in converted wetlands in exclusive farm use zones. Pete Test is here with the Farm Bureau. He will clarify that with the Dash 1 amendments that this allows farmers to continue drainage activities on already farmed and cultivated wetlands. I want to stress that it does not, this bill will not take any, it will not add any acres to production. It does not take any wetlands out and converting that to farmland. We are talking about farmland that is already in production and protects that so that our valley farmers do not have to either stop draining their fields or in order to tile, it will protect them from having to get very expensive assessments to establish to the satisfaction of DSL that they indeed have the right to drain their fields. That's the introduction. I think that's more technical testimony. As does, we got some from Mr. Cleary from Division of State Lands. And I want to say, too, this has been going on a long time with the Division of State Lands since they started in December of 97. We were able to negotiate a release of the cease and desist order. So that is that problem is in suspense, but it is one that easily could come up again either for the Vanels or any number of other farmers in the valley. I want to thank DSL for the work with this. They have responded to the problem and worked with us closely in developing this draft, this amendment that will solve the Vanels problem, but also solve the problem for all of the valley farmers who are similarly situated.
Pete, would you like to go through the amendments, or you want to? Okay, follow up. John, go right
here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands, and one of the areas that I work in is with the wetlands team. One of the difficult things about being in the regulatory business is when you start working in some of these areas where it's difficult to assess a wetland function in a disturbed environment, and it's difficult to apply the law in some of these areas where we're trying to do the right thing, which is to protect wetland functions of water quality protection, wildlife protection, and stormwater drainage, as well as retention, as well as protection for the subsurface water table. These are the kinds of functions that wetlands provide, and they provide those not only in what we might call natural circumstances, but also in altered circumstances. And when you start interfacing, bringing those kinds of functions together in a farmed environment, and we have a regulatory overlay in there, it gets really difficult to make those regulatory decisions. That's the situation we were faced with the Vanel situation. We discovered that really what our observation was is we weren't quite sure what was going on this property, and as a result, there was some replacement tile going on, but there was also some improvement in drainage going on that was driven by some other economic and social requirements. The movement away from field burning meant that folks needed to be able to get in the fields earlier and work. Well, the Willamette Valley, we've all experienced this last winter, is a pretty wet place. And these places in the Willamette Valley that are farmed do create ponded areas that are used by waterfowl. They retain water, which recharges the groundwater, and so on. So, in working together with the Oregon Food and Shelter and the Oregon Farm Bureau, we believe that we've crafted a way to address the concerns of folks like the Vanels, to make it clear for not only the property owners who want to work the ground, but also the regulatory agency
as to what's permissible and what's not. Try to create a brighter line, if you will, so we know with greater certainty where things are regulated and where they're not. This bill does that, and we're pleased to provide our support. We're committed to working, the bill sponsors are committed to working with the division to enhance our regulatory, non-regulatory wetland conservation efforts. And we'll continue to work closely with the Farm Bureau and with other farm operators in this regard. And I thank you for your opportunity, my opportunity to talk to you.
Yes,
thank you.
Yeah.
So, basically, did we have a technical glitch between a wetland overlay and prior converted status? Is that?
Mr. Chair, representative, I think in a nutshell, that's it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that just speaks to my desire to totally remove overlays from the landscape.
It was an opportunity.
I hope that doesn't mean you're going to vote against my bill because it doesn't go far enough.
We have on this amendment too on page 2 on line 6.
Yeah.
I requested some further
comment if you want.
Comment?
I can comment on that
yes,
today if you want. And
I want to make sure it's going to do what I think I want to do here. If not, I will further amend the bill to work on too. I can do that.
For the record, Pete Cash, Associate Director of Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. If it doesn't sound right, we'll make sure that our representative from DSL clarifies for sure, because I will have to admit I'm not a specialist in wetlands and this legislation. I make sure I feel comfortable, but at times a little uncomfortable because we're working with a complex situation. As was said earlier, we got involved in this quite early on in the situation with the Nals and have been working, trying to get this worked out for better than a year. And what I want to do is just make a couple of small points, because I know there's a lot of bills to be done. But the first point I want to be very clear. There's no intention, and if it happens, it's not intended, to in any way drain any further wetlands with this bill. It's basically to be able to repair converted farmland and land that has been converted and used for 150 years or 114 so they continue to crop it. And part of the reason we're in this position is because of the grass seed industry becoming a major industry here and the efforts by the grass seed industry to quit burning. One of the management techniques that they have to do to replace the benefits of fire is rotate crops. To rotate crops means you have to get in the field early enough to plant in the spring. If they're not drained, which they have been in the past, when they did do spring crops prior to grass seed, they kept the drainage systems up over the grass seed. They didn't have to do it. It's perennial. You don't plant in the spring. There's not that need. So now, as they make this effort to avoid burning and have to go back in to get into rotation, they have to bring back their drainage system so they can get in the field, they caught in a catch-22. We're trying to fix the error on this side, and they're caught with some sort of regulation on this side. They're not clear that they can or can't do their fields related to wetlands. And that's kind of in a scenario what's happened. And we're looking at a few weeks difference in time is all to get this ponded water that has a tendency to curve, particularly as wet as rains break down. I talked a little bit about water quality, and I see there's a trade-off between air quality and water quality in this situation. One, if we have more grass seed burning, we're about air, and then we'll have little problems and not a major water quality problem because we don't have to drain. But, you know, there are some benefits to drainage related to water quality. The key to avoiding erosion and sediment in water is to keep more water going into the ground and runs across the top of it. If you have good drainage, getting that water into the ground, and when it comes out of the ground through drainage pipes, it actually comes out cleaner or less sediment than it does with this. So there are some benefits to proper drainage done appropriately as far as water quality is concerned and erosion. So there's a couple of things to consider when we look at this. Again, we have farmers and EFU zone trying to do, and this is simply says these are maintenance and activities you can take in your prior converted farmland to keep yourself, give yourself the ability to continue to produce there. And with that, I don't think it's necessary to go further than that with this information, but if you have questions, I'd be willing to answer, and thank you for the time. Oh, excuse me, talk about your amendments then.
Yes.
Chairman Welsh, early on went and had some problem in his district related to
dike repair, where some dikes have been collapsed over the flooding over the last little bit. They were in good repair and kept up at a foot ground. These dikes were not a problem to the fishery or wetlands in the area. They were used to farm behind them, and they're very, of course, they are not exempt from the removal law, and there's been some real problems getting the ability to repair these dikes. Basically, it's an agriculture practice in repair. So what we've done with the verbiage in here is put in that if repairing these dikes does no further, no more, cause no more adverse effects to wetlands or waters of the state than they did when they were in good form, and they could be repaired.
Right.
And that's generally what those do. And if I miss on that, John, please let me know. And that's what these amendments did, which seem to be very practical and related, again, to maintenance of things that are to keep people farming and not cause problems. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I can engross the amendment, and I can't quite read from line 6.
Any other questions? All right. We got everybody. Anybody else want to speak on this? Okay. I see that down there. Glenn?
For the record, I'm Glenn Stonebank with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. However, my so-called expertise goes back when I was working with U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then shortly after that, I was a consultant with farmers on wetland issues. The significance of this, other than what's been brought out as a good point, is that it would tend to clarify and the differences that have occurred in the past between wetlands fill and removal concepts from the state standpoint and that of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I see this as recognizing that when a wetland is determined by U.S. Department of Agriculture, NRCS, that will be the standard. And I think that would help Division of State Lands. Also, President Clinton, shortly after he took office, put out a white paper that basically declared that NRCS would be the agency to make that decision on agricultural lands. So I think this would go a long ways to simplifying all of it.
I think so. Let me help. Thank you, Glenn. Close the hearing on House Bill 3599. Open a work session on House Bill 3599.
Mr. Chair,
let's see if it's
approved. Move dash one amendment to House Bill 3599.
Let's see if it's approved. Move dash one amendment to House Bill 3599. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any opposition? Hearing none. So moved.
Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I move House Bill 3599 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3591 as a national amendment to the House. Excuse me. 3599 amendment to the floor to do pass recommendation. Look at that. That's funny. Any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Mr. Cruz?
Aye.
Mr.
Aye.
Mandela?
Excuse.
Ms. Andrianella?
Aye.
Ms. Pahori?
Aye.
Ms. Murphy?
Excuse.
Ms. Morgan?
Aye.
Ms. Taylor?
Aye.
Farewell.
Aye. House Bill 3599 as amended. Move to close the due pass recommendation has the appropriate and adequate number of votes. Okay. Superior will be Justice Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my district, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we
help again?
Yeah,
no. We think we are, but we're helping others.
Okay. We will move to a hearing on... Well, no, I have a rescue package here, and I think I'm using this for sure.
Oh.
Hmm. Okay, let's open a hearing on House Bill 3235. Rescue package.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3235 was at the request of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here today to testify on behalf of this bill. House Bill 3235 basically would allocate money that would come as part of the Measure 66 money to the state park and recreation programs back into a grant program for local municipalities that would allow for recreation types of programs specifically aimed at after school or non-school time types of issues. I think that this is a very important issue throughout the state of Oregon. It allows an opportunity to have more and more children involved in parks and recreation programs, as well as keeps kids off the street in terms of latchkeys kinds of programs. And in addition, it also, I believe, is provides some incentives to lower juvenile crime rates. If you look at juvenile crime throughout the state, the primary crime rates occur when those children are out of school, kind of like idle hands do the devil's work. And so that's why I'm in support of this bill. We passed out the parks budget out of Ways and Means, out of the Ways and Means subcommittee previously, but there is $4 million within the existing parks budget that passed out of the full Ways and Means committee this morning for the purposes of grant programs to municipalities. So there is money available for this kind of, not specifically for this program, but there's $4 million available in grant types of programs for parks to come forward and do that. There's also almost $14 million in parks programs that are in reserve and will be held by the E-Board. I would ask this committee to forward this bill on to the Ways and Means Committee to look at. I think it's a noble and good program. It's just a matter of funding in regards to this. I'd be open to any questions in regards to this matter. The only other issue that is out there, and there may be some questions about, and I talked to the Parks Department about, is in regards to how Measure 66 monies are spent in terms of what types of programs they can be spent on. It is my belief that they can be spent on some of these types of programs, especially if they're more capital-intensive kinds of programs, where it would allocate some equipment for some of those kinds of things for parks and recreations programs, as opposed to maybe just strictly strictly paying for people to run the facilities and staff for these parks.
That's some passage. If Jim Walker is on anything up there, if he's in here, I haven't seen that. Might be out in the hall.
I talked to Mr. Lockwood, and that was his concern, the only concern that he gave to me before. I don't want to speak on his behalf, but yeah. The only concern he gave was in terms of how Measure 66 monies are defined constitutionally.
Bring him out from lunch. Another one that signed up to speak. So. God, Jim, come on forward. Let you guys go out of here.
No, I told him that the concern was is how Measure 66 monies are actually spent, and I think that that would be worked out in a way that grants program would be administered by the Parks and Recreation Department to determine what kinds of equipment or facilities could be purchased for these kinds of after school types of programs grants. But it would at least put the emphasis towards those kinds of programs, and that's what I see the legislation do.
Mr. Chair, Jim Lockwood, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I'm getting hoarse. We're either talking here or out there. My apologies for being out in the hallway and talking about another bill that's coming up. The Representative Patridge, I assume, has mentioned that I had raised some question about just the technical wording in Measure 66 and how this applied. We do have a grant program now that works for local government, and I apologize if I'm being redundant here. And we see this as fitting within that program. If there is any question on the bill, the language that would be enacted here, we could probably substantially achieve the same goal through existing authority. So it's one of those things where I have concerns about the way this is written, but I'm not sure that we can't work with this in light of existing law to do the same kind of thing. We're aware of some recreational programs out there that do make a difference in the local level, and Ways and Means has provided in our budget that passed the full committee this morning some local grant funding that comes through Measure 66.
Does does this grant program qualify under the definition of capital investment for the purposes of Measure 66?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, the capital investment piece, to my knowledge, I'm not an attorney, but from my listening to hours of hearings down in Room 50, is that applies to the salmon watershed side, not the park side.
I understand our definition that we have. I'm just wondering if there have been definitions done on the park side of Measure 66 to define specific universes there.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, not that I recall in a way that would affect this, the distinction between the capital investment and the pot of money in the past has been federal money. This is now in our budget. This time is the Measure 66 money to go in, and the criteria are to be worked out with the city, county, and special district parks, and we're to come together with a plan to the emergency board. And so the actual criteria of how that money is to be spent is still actually an open set of possibilities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I sit on that subcommittee of Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see this down in Ways and Means so we can have
some
park
services.
Other
questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none. Close hearing on House Bill 3235 and the work session on House Bill 3235.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Cruz.
I move House Bill 3235 to the Committee on Ways and Means for the due pass recommendation.
And that's Ms. Cruz. Motion is to pass House Bill 3235, which to Ways and Means, and does have subsequent referral to Ways and Means as it is. And
we're going to
send and do pass
send it there.
To the floor.
To the floor?
Yeah.
I wanted to go to Ways and Means.
Just going to Ways and Means. Okay.
That was my motion.
Any discussion? With the due pass recommendation. Hearing none. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Ms. Unella?
Aye.
Ms. Mercury?
Aye.
Ms.
Morgan?
Aye.
Ms.
Taylor?
Aye.
Ms. Farewell? Aye. House Bill 3235, having a required number of votes, passes to Ways and Means, the due pass recommendation. And to the vote on the material, we'll figure it out after that.
Thank you,
Mr. St. Patrick. Okay, we're still at the work session on House Bill 3235, and we'll go back. Representative Murphy.
I was going to ask if you could open 3599 to the recorder vote.
Suspend the rules. Is there any objection? Hearing none? We'll open.
Can I vote before you?
Okay.
Okay.
It doesn't matter to me. And that is House Bill
3599.
Yeah, we open the work session half of 3599, and Representative Murphy would like to record his vote.
Aye.
And that is an aye vote. We close the work session on 3599. Okay. Let's open a work session, a hearing on House of 2979. We have Jay McCauley and Paul Hanneman. So that's a good question. Yes, yes, I see Mr. Pittman's on there too. Yes, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, perhaps I might begin because my comments will be very brief.
And you are?
And I am Paul Hanneman, Cloverdale, Oregon. That's a little place on the coast. I represent today the West Coast Seafood Processors and their position on 2979, which simply is, as Mr. England's mentioned to you previously, a very tiny percent of the waterway lessees are paying 60% of the leases currently to the Division of State Lands. Mr. Pittman, sitting to my left, and Mr. England and I were three of the members who served on the advisory committee to the State Land Board for the past 3 years. But this issue with my family and our waterway on the coast is now 55 years in running since we've been there. And so it's a long, long issue. And I think that's the reason why you have 2979 amendments in front of you now. And I'll just close by saying there were two things that the Advisory Committee to the State Land Board really wanted to have happen, those of us as citizens who served on it. Number one was equity, which we don't have now in the waterway leasing program. And the other was simplicity and the lease rates that people could understand. Now, the amendments 2979-1 come very close to doing that. If they don't do it in all cases, the mechanism on lines 13 to, or the language 13 to 22, leave the committee the option to adjust those, of course. But it's not fair, and it's terribly inequitable to have about 6% of the leases paying 60% of the cost. And it is true, as Mr. England said, the Portland metropolitan area, represented by my colleagues, my friends here today, and those of us on the coast, have worked for the last 3 years to try to bring equity to this program, and we very much appreciate the committee's interest in hearing this before your deadline, and hopefully an attempt to resolve this with the cooperation of the Division of State Lands, we hope, in this legislation. In the remaining time of this legislative session. Thank you very much.
My name is Jay McCauley. I reside at 1555 North Jansen Street in Portland. I am a small consulting business specializing in the environmental and regulatory aspects of marine development. I've been involved with this waterway, this consortium of waterway tenants, as well as attended every public hearing, with the exception of one, every task force meeting. As I said, this is how I make my living. Chairman Welch, members of the committee, I have some prepared testimony that you all have in front of you. After listening to some of the questions, I started to bag that and give further clarification to a couple of the questions that were asked. As it pertains to the inventory, Representative Morgan, I believe, asked the question, how much of it, well, basically asking the status, okay? To my knowledge, approximately 417 miles have been inventoried out of the tens of thousands of miles of waterfront in the state. And that's just describing the navigable areas, let alone the contentious issues as it pertains to the non-navigable areas. Okay, I hope that clarifies it a bit better. Okay, when it comes to, all of our lists have said that there are 443 leases, so it's interesting that they're down to 387. So far, doing just that minor portion of the waterways, they found 2,188 structures. The difference is that they found approximately 2,000 already, but they didn't know that it slipped through the cracks. And John's estimate of 50 to 100 that will turn into leases, he broke it down into registrations versus leases. The program hasn't really gone to that point that level of sophistication yet. They're still ground truthing it. So it's, well, what it comes down to is there are almost 2,000 trusses out there that are going to be either leased or registered, and they both create revenue for the division. Before we get too far into the management issues of the proposed bill, as well as the rules and rates that they're proposing, they got to find out what they're indeed dealing with. So I think that clarification is important in regards to your questions. Representative Taylor asked where the money goes, basically. One important factor here is that the submersible lands are non-trust property. There's no obligation to put that money into the common school fund, as it is with the trust property, which is the grazing property and the forestry property. Okay, now, the constitutional standards for each are the non-trust property, such as, and including the submerged and submersible lands, that they support the greatest benefit to the people of the state, as opposed to the trust properties, where the constitutional standard is the greatest economic benefit to the common school fund. In other words, the legislature, when it came to submerged and submersible lands, recognized the contribution that these marinas and boatyards served as a vital role in creating access in support of the public trust values of navigation, commerce, recreation, fisheries, natural resources, and therefore allowed a rate structure that took that into consideration. That's why some of these lease rates have been notoriously small, such as for lawgrass. Okay, but you don't base the whole program on lawgrass storage rates. I hope that further clarifies. Okay, so what it comes down to is, out of 880,000 acres of submerged and submersible lands, after they take the overhead in regards to the regulatory aspects and the like, natural resource aspects, it amounts to approximately 40,000 a year into the common school fund. So it's either a management issue that they're not given enough money, or there are inefficiencies in management, or something. And that was part of the attempt of the task force to look into those issues. Okay, now, again, I hope that further clarifies what that is. Okay, now, when it comes to the assessed values and the division's model for using assessed values to include locational values, I've done an in-depth study of what that really means. Okay, they base all of their figures on approximately 40% only of the existing leaseholds and call that a statewide average of waterfront, of the assessed values in waterfront property. It came to about $4.07 a square foot. But when you actually look at how that was done on a per item basis, Moe's Restaurant in Newport, for instance, had an assessed value of $412,000 per acre. The example that Mr. Lilly used was River Place, and under our program only generating $90 in revenue under our program. Their assessed value is $415,000. So what they're saying is that this high-priced restaurant in downtown Portland, right on the water, is worth half as much as most annex in Newport. On the Astoria waterfront, you have John England's property at $318,000. You have Astoria Seafoods next door to that at $175,000. An identical operation, Hornstein's, next door to that at $95,000. Downtown Portland, John's Landing, is at $24,000 per acre. Zidell's, they've got two parcels down there. One is at $95,000 and the other is at $63,000. How do you tell Moe's that her property is worth twice as much as River Place, four times as much as the waterfront property for Zidell's? There is absolutely no correlation, none whatsoever. It's not a good model. I would like you to read my testimony because I do deal with these issues in some depth. I try to be brief rather than read that into the record. I'll just leave it at that. I did also bring testimony for Sherry Strand, another member of the task force, and the current president of the Waterfront Owners Association, who strongly supports this bill as well. Do you have any questions for me?
Questions from the committee? Nothing
right now? Sure. I just think that Mr. McCauley's presentation demonstrates the complexity of trying to set a fair rate for lessees. I have met with the waterfront lessees in Astoria, and I guess before I could pass out a bill like this that says we, the legislature, would be setting these fees in statute, I'd have to know exactly how that was going to affect the condominiums in Astoria, the fish processors. I also have real concerns that there could be real winners and losers, and I don't know any log breath persons, but I know that that is a struggling business right now, and so I'm not interested either in putting people out of business. So I am disappointed that we haven't been able to come to some agreement. I really would have a lot of questions to ask, like specifically under the choice model, what businesses would be paying more than they're currently paying, what would be paying the same, who would be paying more. And, you know, I don't know whether we even have the capacity to do that here as committee work.
Representative Taylor, you know, very specifically, those are the same questions that the task force had. And frankly, I was the one that put on the table the inventory because that was the only way to answer those questions. And frankly, it turned out to be a wonderful tool for the division, but they bought into it kicking and screaming the whole way. They didn't think it was necessary at the task force level when we pursued the issue for the very reasons that you speak of. They reluctantly did. Steve Purchase, who was a member of the task force and assistant director of the DSL, said, maybe we'll find 100 new structures statewide. Right now, they've already found 2,000. And they have only done less than 1% of the waterways. When it comes to the nuts and bolts, you know, after having done this for almost 4 years, we do have some of those answers, and that's what we boil down into this bill. You know, to give you an idea, the first model presented by the division would have increased the annual mortgage for my mortgage from about $7,500 to $75,000. Well, no, but this is before the choices were offered. Okay, now the choices that are offered now would range, and we're paying about $8,000 now under this freeze. It would go to either $23,000, which is a threefold increase, or $29,000, which is obviously not a choice we would take, or if you use the assessed upland value, $568,000 per year. Okay, I think it just indicates the lack of validity to that choice model. And frankly, they have calculated no fiscal impacts to the tenants or to their existing leaseholders. And I believe it's their statutory obligation to have done that prior to getting to this stage. None of that's been done, Representative Taylor. We've done a great deal of amount of work toward it, but we're not the keepers of the facts and the figures. We have to make our own.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Mark Sherfing Lucky.
I think as I kind of reflect on this, the fundamental issue is how the state operates in a responsible way in running out these properties. And in general, you either appraise them or you auction them, or you set some fee in statute. The disadvantage of setting the fee in statute is it doesn't account for the differences in the value of one property from another, and everyone knows that an acre in downtown Portland is worth quite a bit
different amount than an acre in eastern Oregon, and the same would apply to different stretches in the waterway. So it seems that, as I hear you talking about appraisal inequities, one way this is handled in normal land appraisals is you have an appeal process. Is there an appeal process currently in place for the appraised value as reflected in these rentals?
Yes, you know, and it's interesting to bring that up, Berkeley. These issues came up again at the task force and throughout our public meetings and meetings to this day. Okay, now, there are two levels to answer that question on. If they use the assessed values as the model, then the only appeal process is to get the property appraised, and appraisals are typically very expensive for marine property. Then you would have to go into the assessor's office and appeal your assessment. You would have no direct appeal to the Division of State Lands. Okay, and one of the issues that I've been trying to drive into the rule promulgation process is an appeals process, and the Division has just seen fit not to put an appeals process into the proposed rules. You can appeal certain decisions to the director, but frankly, I don't think that's what they had in mind when I know that's not what I had in mind when I was asking for an appeals process through the administrative rule procedures. So to answer your question, either through the assessor's office or to the director, and that's it. Okay, now we had at one point interjected the verbiage of putting appraisals into an appeals process, as well as a tenant advisory board to review certain hardship cases, for instance, as well as certain rates that are obviously inequitable, and that was pretty much poo-pooed. The appraisal process has been put back into it, but it's at the expense of the tenant. Typically, in a landlord-tenant situation, the landlord would know the value of his property probably through an appraisal process. In this case, the state lands has no obligation to do that as landlord. They're putting that solely on the responsibility of the person who wants to lease the property.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up there. Yes. Well, then, do you feel that an improved appraisal process or appeals process would get you closer to your objective while honoring the common sense knowledge that different pieces of land have different values, or different pieces of water, in this case, have different values in different parts of the field?
Actually, there are two ways of doing that without appraising every piece of riparian property in the state. At tremendous cost to the state and to the riparian landowners. One, if you're going to take a statewide average of waterfront property, you don't narrow the field to 233 leaseholders to come up with that statewide average. The fact is, in that statewide average, there was not one single Eastern Oregon parcel factored into the, quote, statewide average. If you were to take a statewide average of all riparian property, and face it, the Eastern Oregon farmers have riparian rights as well. If you were to factor it like that, it would be a significant way to narrow down exactly what the values and the basis for the waterway leasing rates should be. That would be a terrific way of doing it. Okay, now the other aspect, and this is why we drove the inventory aspect so hard. Unless you have an idea of what you're actually dealing with in a map form, so you can calculate the acres, not just estimate them, so you can track the uses of this public resource, then what's the point of even getting the assessed values on a statewide basis? I mean, you've got to know what you're dealing with. And to this point, that still has yet to be done. I think clearing up those two aspects would give us a good idea what the rates really ought to be.
Thank you. May I have more testimony?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welch, committee members, my name is Mel Pittman. I reside in 1934 Southeast Lambert, Portland. I represent the Columbia River Yachting Association as the umbrella group of 18 organized boating organizations, and my particular, in particular, Rose City Yacht Club. Having served at the inception on the Governor's Task Force to review the asset management plan and the following 3.5 years of meeting and workshop, I'm here to ask for your support of the bill as amended. The statewide coalition of leaseholders have asked the Division of State Lands to adopt the graduated flat rate proposal, which would correct the identified inequities which they have allowed to exist. The choice model continues to level additional rates that were identified by the tax force as completely unconsciously unfair. There is an escalation built into the choice model over and above the existing inequity. With the constructive input from the statewide coalition to establish a fair and equitable return and meet all the goals of the governor's task force, I would ask your support of House Bill 2979 as amended. Upon completion of a complete waterway inventory, additional revenue will increase as new unleased parcels and registrations are brought into compliance. I'll be happy to respond to any questions. Thank you for the opportunity of coming before this committee. We really value your insight into a very complex set of issues. It's not an easy one to resolve. We would like very much to stand next to the Director of the Division of State Lands before the Land Board and support the flat rate proposal, but so far we seem to have a number of issues that are unresolved. And rather than get into all the individual aspects of it, if there isn't time permitted here before this group, we would be more than happy to respond to you at any time. Once again, thank you for your indulgence.
Okay, I've got some other things I want to move on with, and I certainly do not understand all the aspects of this yet and don't feel comfortable moving the bill at this point in time. Well, I see I have some reading material, a little background here to give me some insight, and you as resources out here in the division. We'll take this up next week. Okay?
Sure. Thank you,
very much. Thank you very much. Close the hearing. 2979. And we have any other members in here? We have just saw a lady here from down on the coast on the river. She must have just got some
trees.
Very good. As soon as they get here, we'll take that up. In the meantime, I will do a little housework here. I think you look on page 3. We're going to tap in and out a few of these and take care of some work here. Open a hearing on House Bill 3089. Close the hearing on House Bill 3089. Open the hearing on H.J.R. 46 and close the hearing on H.J.R. 46. We open a hearing on House Bill 2591 and close the hearing on House Bill 2591. I think on that same page, I'll open the hearing on House Bill 3419 and close the hearing on House Bill. Do we have Don? Do you want to talk on that one? Okay, well. Which one? Oh, that's much, yeah, Don. We'll allow Don to talk on that one in a minute. Okay. We've got representatives here. If you could just sit up in the front here for a minute,
okay.
And then I'll bring them forward, and then we'll have you next.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to open the hearing on House Bill 3060. Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Leslie Lewis. I'm a state representative for District 29. and I've come to you today with House Bill 3060. And this bill is designed to fix a problem that Debbie Owens here, and I'll have her testify to the bill so she can explain to you exactly what their situation is. But it's a problem that has come about on some property that Mr. and Mrs. Owens owns, and it's a problem dealing with being able to use an existing septic system. And I would like to really just turn it over to Ms. Owens and have her explain to you her problem. But this really is the only solution they have at this point. They have tried to work with DEQ, and that just hasn't proven to be fruitful. And so we need to bring this legislation forward to try to solve the problem. And with that, I would ask that we turn it over to Debbie Owens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Deborah Owens, and I live in Dundee, Oregon. My husband and I bought this building back in 1993. The building was originally built with a permit in July of 1977, and it was located in a marine commercial zone on the Sluts River in Lincoln City. And if you'll look at some of the attachments that are I have a picture of the layout of the property. It's on the very back of the packet. You can see by the pictures that we're very limited as far as the width of the property in siding a new septic system. But this building, when it was constructed, it's a three-level structure, had living quarters on the third level, and a septic system installed at the time the building was constructed. And at that time, marine commercial zone, one family dwelling wasn't permitted outright use in that zone. And as you can see on Exhibit 1, that's the original permit for the building. And it was also had a variance granted on this parcel to place the building within 4 feet from the river and 4 feet from the highway right-of-way. In all actuality, the building was placed within 1 foot of the highway right-of-way. And so it makes it even worse for us now dealing with it. The building has been utilized as a residence for 22 years. We've not asked for a change in use. We bought the building as a residence. It's a fixture, you know, building, but we saw the potential of making it something special, something that would take us a few years to complete. And as you can see on Exhibit 2, I've made a list of people that have lived in the building in the past. I've talked directly with these people. It's not everybody, but at least it was, you know, some background information for you to evaluate. Exhibit 3 is the original earnest money agreement where we purchased the property, and I was very, you know, I was concerned with the property myself when I bought it, so I asked the realtor to tell me everything he knew and to be sure to know that it was a residential piece of property with the septic system already hooked up because it was sitting so close to the river. And in the next Exhibit 4 is, you know, where the document that he provided us prior to us purchasing the property, it showed that the system had just recently been pumped, and this was prior to our purchase. Exhibit 5 is the conditional use permit that we were required by the county to get because they didn't recognize it as a residence. We did receive approval on the conditional use permit, and there were stipulations. You'll notice on the conditional use permit, the staff report, it notes that they recognize it already has a septic system and living quarters on the property. But according to the county records, there was nothing on file as far as a permit for the septic system, so they asked us to apply for a new permit. So we did that. But of course, because of our land restrictions, we were turned down. You need to be 50 feet from the riverbank to place the line for the septic system. So far to date, my husband and I, we've got over $100,000 into this piece of property, and we can't even live in it. We can't remodel it. We can't sell it. We can't convey it. It's kind of one of those things you wish you wouldn't have gotten into it, but, you know, I thought that we could work out all of these issues with the county and the other agencies in resolving the problems that we came up with on the property. We've continuously tried our best, to our best ability, to work with the county. But in 97, they filed civil action against us as a public nuisance under the abatement ordinance from Lincoln County. And they wanted us to, you know, basically, they were basically in essence saying that we had constructed the living quarters and the septic. But it had been there since 1977, since the building had been built. Well, now, to kind of wrap it up for you, because I do have a lot of documentation that you can certainly review at your own leisure, but we're just about out of avenues to chase to try to resolve the problems that we're now faced with. With this bill, as proposed, it would simply allow us to keep the build or use the building as it is right now or has been in the past. It's a two-bedroom, one-bath, and we're not asking, the system has never failed, never been a complaint on the system, and we have no recourse against the realtor or the previous owners because of time limitations. The realtor did disclose the facts that he knew, although he said he wasn't privy to the fact that it wasn't a permitted system. So I'm putting my cards on the table. I'm running out of options here in trying to resolve this issue, and I just ask that you support this bill in my husband's and my behalf. It's a big chunk of money out of our retirement fund, and we're really running out of options and would really like to have your support. But also, as one last note, I'm not opposed. The bill is written so generic it would have impact statewide, and I can see the concern that DEQ would have with the bill as it is written. I'm not opposed to the bill to be changed or modified to make it property specific, and I'll be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Using these photographs, where is the system on the property?
It sits. On this side of the property, this is just like a lean-to or a covered area. The septic system actually sits right up next to the building, and the lines run out into the open area. We've not completely, you know, dug up the system. We have exposed the tank for the county, but it's located it's right up next to the building.
And so, I have another question. The problem is you can't, you're not within the setbacks, and so you can't get past that hurdle. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Morgan, you have to, the septic system, now the requirement is that you have to have the septic system in line 50 feet from a river bank. I'm not sure what the guidelines were back in 1977. They were pretty vague, actually, in the county ordinances at that time. The county didn't come into compliance with state land use law until, I believe, it was 1982, so they didn't have it adopt a comprehensive plan and zoning ordinance to meet that requirement. The thing is that I feel that the property was constructed, and maybe it wasn't done correctly. But I'm not asking for you to permit, you know, allow me to use a system that's failed or is not operating properly. It's a mistake that occurred back in 1977, and I am out of resources or means to try to remedy the situation. I could see if I have to expand the use as it's currently used, but the system has worked appropriately since 77 that I know of. I've checked the files. There's never been a complaint filed on the system.
It is, but there's no documentation on file anywhere about when this was installed or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I served as Dan Half Penny. As far as this property, there's no documentation on file at the county. When I served as county commissioner in Yamhill County from 91 to 94, we had several of these kind of properties come up before us. And a lot of times, you know, this is before computerization, documents were lost, you know, mm-hmm. but you have to look at, you know, do you have a system that works, or has it failed, you know, has it been reported? You would think that the county representatives would try to resolve this issue without putting us at this point that we are now asking for a change of law. But that's not the case.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if I might, the building was built in 1977 with a permit. And presumably, you know, one must presume, and back in the 70s, because I also own a property that had a septic system put in the 70s, and records were not very good at that time, and I know I relate to you my difficulty, our difficulty in finding our septic system. We knew it was somewhere on the 33 acres, but but the records were so poor we weren't exactly sure where. So that was kind of the norm back in the 70s, but the fact that the county, you know, allowed the structure to be built, I think there's got to be a presumption that they had approved the septic system as well, and maybe they didn't make any separate approvals in the 70s in Lincoln County. I think it would be difficult to know for sure what the records of that are.
But there are records that exist about the building permits for this building. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the county's, Lincoln County's report notes that the building was put up as an old construction repair facility. Is that consistent with the building permit, that material that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's what the original permit says. It's a pole building or for remodeling and reworking boats is what it was built for.
And so they probably, I'm imagining that the folks who were living there over these years probably did so without officially converting it to a residence, but they just took up residence, if you will, and no one complained and were able to live there during those years, other than getting the building converted to a residence, per se.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, one of the people that lived in the building, you know, the county says that they didn't have any records of this there being a residential structure, but I've talked directly to the man that built the building. He put the residence in and the septic system when he built the building. There's been county employees that have been in the building. In fact, one of the sanitarians, his sister, lived in the building with her four children. So, you know, there's prior knowledge by the county that this building was used as a residence. And this was back in the 80s, right after the building was built. His sister lived in the building. And, you know, so they have prior knowledge. I can't fix all of the problems that have occurred since 77 up to the date now. I'm just simply looking for an avenue to try to slow down the train, so to speak, and give us some breathing room.
When I first was looking at this, the first thing that flashed in my mind was using a holding tank within a septic system, because the whole reason you have a setback from a river is because you want everything to get digested sufficiently before it gets into the waterway, especially when you're in a floodplain. And then as I read more carefully, I saw you had proposed that option in 94, and I gather it's come up again recently. After filing this bill, maybe the county thought that forward as an option?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, actually, I talked to Stephanie Halleck, I believe it is, from DEQ, and she had brought it up again as an issue, and this is just a recent phone conversation. And since my talk with Stephanie, I did check on what would the cost be to have a holding tank. That holding tank would normally be approved for like a commercial facility. And for a 2,000-gallon tank, it's not so much the cost of installing the tank is costly, it's the pumping. 2,000-gallon tank costs $175 every time you pump it. And you're looking at probably the two people living there, you know, and on a full-time basis. I don't think it would last, you know, probably about 10 days to 14 days. you're looking at over $350 a month to use the holding tank.
Okay, other questions, Justin? Devlin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The roadway that's in front of the property, approximately what's the distance there? It looks like it's a good 40 to 50 feet from your picture here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, the right-of-way, the ODOT right-of-way through this area is 80 feet, which one side is river and the other side is wetland. You know, and I cannot foresee in the future this highway ever being expanded. It's the Sluts River Highway. It's a small highway only that services a small portion of Lincoln County. I did approach ODOT about possibly them selling back some of their right-of-way to me so I could place the lines in their current right-of-way area, only, you know, selling it back to me. And that was with the meeting I set up with Senator George had set up with me and ODOT and DEQ and my attorney. And we thought we were going to, you know, get some cooperation, but they came back to us 2 or 3 days later and said they didn't want to set a precedent, you know, selling back right-of-way. But I personally cannot see them ever doing improvements to this highway because they would have to expand out into the river and into the wetlands.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to comment that I've been in some fairly extensive meetings with ODOT where committees have urged them to sell off excess right-of-way. So I find it kind of interesting in this case. Thank you for the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair of Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll bring the assessing and how it's being due. Then,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the administrator of DEQ's Eastern Region. I'm also the acting administrator of the statewide on-site program. And with me today is Dennis Illingworth, who's the technical program manager for on-site. I'll be brief. I won't read you my testimony. I just want to say that we empathize very much with Deborah Owens' situation, the objection we have is that we are a statewide agency, and we are, in fact, as Ms. Owens said, concerned about the statewide ramifications of exempting systems, all systems statewide prior to 1979. This is a very difficult and unfortunately not uncommon situation in the state of Oregon. I've got a huge one of these over in Deschutes County, where there were properties approved a long time ago that are not buildable. And we have been working on a number of solutions to that problem. There are others around the state. In terms of options, up until this point, as you may or may not know, counties can run the on-site program as on a contract with DEQ if they choose to do so. And Lincoln County has been administering the on-site program on our behalf. And as you've heard, they've had a lot of discussions with the Owens, and there's currently litigation. We have not until recently been very much of a player in the dialogue. We did have the meeting with ODOT. Dennis attended that on my behalf. I've written a letter to Deborah in which I suggested the possibility of the holding tank, and as you heard, the pumping cost would potentially be prohibitive for them. There are some other possible systems. They are all more expensive than a standard on-site system, and I think what the Owens are hoping is that there is some solution involving the property where they could somehow make a standard system work. Dennis has spoken directly with their consultant, who is a very good consultant from Cascade Earth Sciences. He also has some reservations about the site for a standard system. But there may be some other kinds of systems, and we would be the agency to work on the permitting requirements rather than the county. And there is an administrative process that should the Owens choose to do it, they could go through with our agency to discuss those options. Unfortunately, there will be costs associated with all of these, and I think that is understandably a concern to them. So to make a long story short, we emphasize we would like to help solve the problem. I talked to Ms. Owens before the hearing if she thought it would help to have me contact the county commission or have my directors contact them. I'd be happy to help if we could explore other options. But we must be on record as against the bill because of our concerns about the statewide ramifications.
Okay, why couldn't they use this property if the present system is there, that they found that it has not failed? Why couldn't they continue to use that for a period of time while we try to find some other solution?
Do you want to answer that?
Chair Welch, for the record, I'm Dennis Lillingworth with the Department of Environmental Quality. It is our understanding from the county, and again, it's only our understanding, Chair, that they have not been able to locate any drain field on this site. They do have a tank, but they have not been able to locate any drain field, and they've had extensive probing, and apparently the Owens installer has actually tried to find one, too, and they have not been able to find one.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Other questions?
Sure. So, it's your impression that the tank is almost serving as a digesting tank in essence at this point?
Chair Wells, Representative Merkley, we're not sure what's on the site other than a tank. We cannot find anything else, or the county cannot find anything else. It's a tank. Whether it goes out into a cesspool, a line to the river, we don't know, sir.
The great amount of water that goes into a holding tank is bath water, shower water, so on and so forth, as opposed to sanitary waste. Are there technologies that are permitted whereby one can filter and pump water out of a holding tank and through the filtering process essentially release it onto the surface or whatever, such that a holding tank wouldn't have to be pumped so often? Is there anything permitted like that meets the DEQ's concerns?
Chair Welch, Representative Merkley, at this time there is no technological cost-effective type of a system that would do that. Their technology is there to do that, but you would be into something way prohibitive for a single-family residence.
What about a sand filter?
Chair Welch, a sand filter treats the effluent partially. It does not treat it fully. It still has to go into a drain field. And we still have to get rid of the water somehow, with high groundwater, with seepage possibly to the river. That's an option that can be explored under the WPCF permit. It's the other permit that Stephanie was speaking of. That permit process allows a system to be engineered specifically for a site. But it takes a qualified consultant, of which they do have. Brian Rank is a very good consultant, to look at that and come up with a design that could be approved by the department. It does not necessarily mean, though, sir, that this particular property could be solved that way. The potential.
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of other systems similar to that Dennis can give you all the technical information you'd like about them.
When was the last time when a family actually lived there and used that system?
Chair Welch, Representative Morgan, I don't have any direct knowledge of that.
Can we get the applicant to come forward?
Chairman Welch, and Representative Morgan. We bought the property in 93, and the
Paul Amato and his wife lived in the building up till, I believe it was May or June of that year.
And do you know the length of time that they lived there?
They had lived there over 2 years. It was almost 3 years.
Is there any documentation about problems that developed with the system during that period of time?
No, I went to the, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I went to the county and I copied every document on file on that site, you know, for the subject concerning that piece of property. There's nothing in file. I talked with the sanitarian. He's never had a complaint filed against that piece of property or for that system. There's nothing in writing in the county file.
Okay. Mr. Sheriff, I mean, do you know if you ever did a dye test? Or anyone did a dye test,
that would tell Mr. Chair whether or not the sewage was going into the river.
Do you know if one was ever done?
No, I do not. There was a mention of needing a dye test if they wanted to do anything or something with the property on a folder, on the back of a folder.
May I have one more question?
Yes.
Based on your knowledge of the soil types and the site, would it be reasonable to assume that if two people used that system for 2 years and there was no drain field, that there would be the that you would see sewage on the ground somewhere?
Chair Wells, Representative Morgan, if in fact it was an open space where that water would surface, yes. If it ran into a wetland or a heavy vegetated area, some of that property appears to be, or into the river. The only potential there is if somebody happened to smell it as they were fishing along the river or something and complained.
You wouldn't see, there wouldn't be a place on the river where there was slime, you wouldn't expect to see some kind of manifestations of raw sewage?
Chair Wells, Representative Morgan, not necessarily, no. It really depends on the river, how it reacts. I have personally seen instances where you cannot possibly tell other than by dye testing or bacteriological sampling.
I keep thinking there must be some way to tackle this, and I realize this probably isn't really the place to do all this brainstorming. I want to see this.
Managing
or, yeah. I want to see this family figure out the problem. Yet another approach is for them to be able and permitted to pump their sewage up into a trailer and trailer it somewhere to dispose of it themselves as opposed to hiring. And I don't know, I'm assuming there are other problem properties where ideas have been worked out and fixes have been found that prevented the problems with environmental pollution. And are there other such solutions that have worked elsewhere that with some statutory adjustment here we could permit them to use in this location?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, as I mentioned in Saskatchewan County where we have some similar problems, the solutions that are being looked at are in fact these alternative types of systems that we've been discussing. I have personally not heard of the suggestion that you made, and I don't know if that is has been considered by anyone. But to be frank about it, there are some properties for which there have been no solutions, and the solutions have been legal, either between private property owners. In some cases, there have been tort claims against the county or the state. And this goes back to land use decisions that were made a long time ago, and unfortunately, individual property owners who suffer because of them.
Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm doing a little bit of what Representative Merkley was trying to do. In some places where water is scarce in previous years, I've seen people even advocate for what we refer to as gray water systems. Would that type of a system be legal in this state? I mean, if you treated the effluent differently from how you treated gray water from the property, which that will make up the vast majority of the material that you need to dispose of.
Chair Wells, Representative Devlin, we do have split waste systems where you can actually do something like a composting toilet. incinerator, toilet, that type of thing, and then have some type of a system for gray water disposal. Depending on the particular situation and the particular site, it could either be under a construction installation permit issued through the county, or on a difficult site like this, this could be something that can be looked at under the engineered system.
But gray water is being, Mr. Chairman, normally being defined as like the water that would come from, washing, et cetera, which would be the bulk of laundry, dishwasher, et cetera, et cetera. What would the disposal requirements would that be? I mean, I've known of places where they basically use that to water the lawn.
Well, Representative Devlin, gray water is still considered to be sewage. You have, when you have wash water, now in this particular instance, I'm not suggesting that they have small children, but when you look at it overall, you have wash water that has diapers in it, you have shower and bath water. It is still something to be considered to be a public health concern. It is not something that we look upon lightly, but it is something that we have been looking at for subsurface irrigation, that type of situation, where it would still be under the ground, but much less treated, as we may say, than the black waste.
All right. Thank you very much. Having not, I'll talk with Deborah and with the rest of Lewis further next week, and I don't see a solution at hand right at the moment. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3060. We'll open on House Bill 3419. Representative Cruz will take over for a minute here.
Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Yes, Chairman Cruz. We've heard you now as Chairman. I'm Don Fell from Astoria. You have before you a packet, a small briefing I've put together. I've talked to a number of you before. It's my pleasure to speak to you, and I thank you for your time, and I will try to keep this short. I've heard from a number of legislators that they lament that the term limits, they have a hard time seeking long-term solutions, and quite often we just put band-aids on things. This, what we present today, is to look at a long-term solution to something that is a health problem. In this room alone, you have 108 fluorescent lights, and each one of them has a quarter gram of mercury in them. Mercury, as everyone knows, is a health problem. The effects of mercury, I'm going to stage two. We know that it attacks the central nervous system, the brain, the kidneys. There's many known health problems, including death. And there's many diseases that are unknown cause, but they are attributed by the researchers to probable mercury or heavy metals in the water, which mercury is the most reactive. There's been a number of testimonies earlier this year. Randy Miller told me about them in the Senate, and it referred to an article that was in the Oregonian on January 30th. Oregon leads the nation in Parkinson's disease for number 3 and Alzheimer's. The problem with mercury was first addressed in the Waste Reduction Act of 97, and there's an OAR 340-113. And I would like to quote from the OAR, although the amount of mercury in each plant is small, several million are discarded by Oregon businesses and government each year, making these lamps possibly the largest source of mercury in our solid waste stream. I like one of the parts I didn't include in the writing. The next paragraph refers that the mercury that comes from these contaminates our air, our surface water, and our groundwater. These fluorescent lights is the largest source of mercury contamination. DEQ estimated in 1997 there was 12 million source light bulbs discarded by Oregonians. I was talking to Rick Wolpel, who was a DEQ arson expert, and he was telling me that only 2-3% of these lamps are being buried, and he said some of them are being recycled, but with very few at the hazardous landfills, and they require DEQ to monitor them every year, and those businesses that have put them there are still liable. Who are the businesses that we have to process our lamps? When you look at the OAR, a small quantity handler is someone who has less than 11,000 pounds of waste. Only the very big businesses, the Intels, and the governments themselves have to send their fluorescent light bulbs to either a recycler or to a landfill. So what happens is that 98% of the fluorescent light bulbs are handed by small businesses. Even a very large mall would not have 11,000 pounds of fluorescent light bulbs. And as you all know, this building, malls, and us have lots of them. We have 16 fluorescent light bulbs, for example, in our house. We've gone through, we try to convert to energy efficiency. The OAR does not address these producers of this toxic waste. And most people, and I've talked to a couple hundred people now, do not realize they take the fluorescent light bulb, they go to the garbage can to get rid of it. This is only 3 feet long, they're 4 feet. It doesn't fit in the garbage can. What does the average person do? They break it. And you release the mercury that was encapsulated in the fluorescent light bulb. How many times have you driven behind a dump truck and you see it going zip down the road? You know the fluorescent light bulbs are going to get broke. They don't make it to the landfill. And so what we're doing is we're dumping, in essence, almost 12 million fluorescent lights, the mercury from them, on our neighborhoods. I have a letter in your packet that is from the Sierra Club, and they have, do I have a copy of it? They said, because of the cumulative effect, we need to look at this problem. Most of them are broken in the neighborhood. But is there a way that we can solve this problem? The problem, if we look at it, is building codes require more and more fluorescent lights. The fluorescent light normally saves a person $30 over its lifetime in the energy it saves. And what we're talking about, if this works, if the process works, is that we would have a small charge of $1 to $2 to pay to have the bulb processed and chemically treated. What does chemically treating mean? If we take hydrogen, everybody knows that hydrogen is odorless, colorless, it's highly flammable, but when you burn hydrogen, you can't even see it. You remember the pictures of the Hindenburg, that it burned, and it burned very, very quickly. It was still full of hydrogen. You didn't see the hydrogen burn, you saw the blimp. We can take hydrogen, which is highly flammable, we can chemically convert it to a non-toxic fluid that you bathe in, that you drink, and that you water your plants with. You can radically change something that's hazardous to something that we use every day. The same way we can take mercury and we can tie it up so it's chemically tied up and is not reactive and cannot cause a problem because it's not toxic. For example, what does that mean? If you're looking at the atoms, and the atoms look like a big checkerboard, and everybody's played checker or chess, and if you took out one of the black squares and you put a mercury in there, take that up, and you can tie it up chemically so that it's not reactive, it's non-hazardous. We can solve the problem, not bury it. Mm-hmm. My background is a whole lot of research. Talks about my educational background on here. And the skills, I've done work for DOE, DOD, Navy, Army, NASA, a lot of that's classified. What we're trying to do is bring some of that technology that the average person can never get to and solve an existing problem that affects our health. I've made arrangements with Oregon Graduate Institute to do much of the work there. The problem is that they don't have all the equipment. The two of my alma maters are the University of Washington and Penn State. They do have the equipment, and I have access. In fact, I still have the keys to Penn State. I can get in and use the equipment to do this work. In summary, everyone knows that mercury is a health problem. We need a long-term solution, not a band-aid. 98% of the spent plants that have mercury in them are not being processed. They're being broken in the neighborhood. They go to the landfill, they still can get out. They can still cause a problem. We can chemically process them and make them non-toxic. The cost to recycle. I have in here from the organ recyclers. Information as late as May of this year, their edition, should be March. And they only know of one recycler in Seattle, and it is a small unit that takes a few tubes at a time. There's a number of places that have been licensed to recycle, but aren't recycling much, because the cost to recycle is a whole lot more than sending it to the landfill. This process that we are proposing is even cheaper than sending it to the landfill that this body of legislators are going to have to, if you're here in 2 years or 4 years or whoever your replacements of gremlins, will have to keep paying to have them monitored more and more and more. I would appreciate your support for this bill. And if you have any questions, please answer them. Thank you.
Any questions? What's under mercury?
What is the purpose of this mercury in the vaults? It's very short.
Chairman Wells, Representative Mercury. To conduct this light, you have to conduct electricity. You need something that's conductor. There's a phosphate in a focus bulb that fluoresces.
This is in vapor form?
And so it's a liquid pre vapor as it gets warm, and it's a conductor. And phosphorus do not conduct electricity, so you need something that causes electricity to flow.
Mm-hmm. So it's in a vaporized form when the bulb is operating?
It's in a vapor and a liquid as it gets warm. Yeah, it's such a thing.
If I can follow up. You had mentioned, I think, charging a fee on lights to help pay for this, but I don't see that in your bill.
No, the bill is, this is to look down the road. I was working with Representative Kurt Schreier and Senator Lim and Sinceri and saying, how do we address this long term? So let's verify the process, and then we would come back in 2 years and say we would like to suggest some type of a bill that uses our current recycling program. We have over 90% of Oregonians have a recycling program, or they could take their bulb to the place that they bought a new one. Most people don't realize that they're hazardous. And so that would be the next step. This right now is to look at, let's verify that this can be done.
The main thing that strikes me is, and I think you're trying to tie up the mercury in a ceramic, but okay. The main thing that strikes me is this type of basic materials research. Isn't there a federal environmental grants to fund this type of basic research?
Chairman Wells, Representative Mercury, I talked to Senator Gordon's this office, and they suggested the same thing. I went looking there. I have probably 3 or 4 inches of stuff where I have gone through EPA, and they do not have that type of, because they don't think there's a solution. They do not have the funds. I was hoping to find them that way when some of the people had suggested, I can't remember which representative recommended that to me in the very beginning, but those are not funds that are available.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you.
We have Hillary Abrams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council. We OEC opposes this bill, but I'd like to just sort of make a statement that there are a lot of areas that I think we agree with Mr. Fell. Specifically, we agree that mercury is a biocumulative toxin and it needs to be addressed very, very specifically. However, I think we disagree with the means by which we should deal with this issue, and that's going to be the basis of my testimony. Essentially, what this bill seeks to do is create funding for research on the chemical treatment of mercury in solid waste. Mercury, obviously, is an extremely hazardous chemical to human health in sufficient amounts. It is capable of causing serious damage to the nervous system, to the brain, and can result in birth defects, cerebral palsy, and other developmental abnormalities. But it's our understanding that the ultimate goal of this research is the development of a treatment method that would stabilize the mercury in discarded fluorescent light tubes that are disposed of in solid waste landfills. Oregon has a highly successful secondary mercury recovery program. Over 800,000 pounds of mercury-containing lamps were recycled in 1998. Any funds directed towards preventing the release of mercury into the environment from fluorescent lamps should be directed towards increasing the number of mercury-containing lamps for recycling, and not towards developing stabilizing techniques. So therefore, we urge you to oppose this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Currently, if I take my bowls to a hazardous waste location, what happens to them at that point? So I've been responsible, drop them off with my paints and solvents and so forth. What happens at that point?
My understanding is that DEQ has a program that will take it from there, and I think they're going to testify after me, so they would be able to answer that question more poignantly than I can.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. And I want Lori Unan, DEQ.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lori Onan with the Department of Environmental Quality. You'll notice the testimony you're about to receive in writing has Bob Danker's name in it, and he would have been here today to speak to this, but he is out sick today. So I'll be very brief.
I hope he's not too sick playing golf.
He is.
No, Mr. Chair, he's actually...
Okay, I hope he
House Bill 3419 provides $300,000 of general funds to the department to conduct this research. And the first thing I would note is that this amount is not in the governor's recommended budget. And as we already heard from Oregon Environmental Council, there is significant recycling of mercury in fluorescent lamps. And we also agree this is the preferred approach. There is a chart in the back of my testimony that shows in just the last 2 years how much more recycling has been occurring of this material. And while it's extremely important to keep mercury out of the environment, we think that any funding for this from the state should be focused on collection of these lamps so that the mercury can be recycled. And with that, I'll stop and answer any questions that I am able to.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, thank you. What percent of the lamps are currently recycled in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I have information that was prepared that it's estimated that 22% of mercury-containing lamps are recycled in Oregon.
And are those recycled because we the citizens, drop them off at, along with our solvents and paints, or how are they recycled? Because I have to admit, I'm guilty. I have done exactly what Mr. Fell talked about. And I suspect there's a few other guilty parties here at the table.
When are you up for re-election?
In fact, I think my wife had a conversation with the recyclers whether we could put them in our yellow bin, and I don't think we could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no, these are not collected curbside, and you bring up a good point. I believe if you check, you'd find that a lot of the recycling comes from the larger facilities that have the ability to collect a lot and then transmit them to places that can deal with them in a bulk way. Just like many other items that are used in households, it's difficult to figure out a way to do a cost-effective collection and how you would do that. Another issue came up about recycling other materials here, and one of the things that, in fact, it had to do with the pool chlorine that's used in trying to keep that out of the waste. That's another bill that's in the Senate side. And one of the things that we always say is that if you're going to try to get this material out of the waste stream on a household level, it really does involve a lot of public education. So you'd have to have outreach efforts to educate folks about what the alternatives are, and you'd have to have alternatives available. So that's something that would have to be looked at for any type of recycling.
How do these 22%, since we can't put them in our yellow buckets, how do these 22% get recycled?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, again, I believe the bulk of that is from larger facilities who can take them to directly to the recycling facilities. And it's more difficult to collect them household by household.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on, your life should be fine.
Close hearing on 3419. Let's do a little more housekeeping here. Caught up to a couple more, I think, down to
Mr. Can I make one comment before we go on? I'd just like to thank Mr. Fell very much for bringing this bill forward. Since it's not clear what the ultimate outcome will be, I just want to note that thank you very much for wrestling with this problem and making us all think about it. I think most of us, when our households, wrestle with what to do with those things when they go bad. And thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes.
When we break the light bulb like that, have we done any harm for it?
No, I close the hearing. I'm just moving on here.
Mr. Chair, I think we need to get a couple of bills for Joe.
He's enjoyed the hearing so far, I'm not out.
We have a couple of them. I'll move on from here. Did you have a question? Let's go. HJR 38, we'll open hearing. HJ 38, we close hearing. And House Bill 3541, we open hearing. House Bill 3541, we close hearing. Waiting, I think, some more. Yeah, those amendments on the way. House Bill 2468, I understand the problem has been taken care of. Joe can talk to us about it, but I won't ask him much. So we'll House Bill 2468, we're open hearing. House Bill 2468, let's go. We'll House Bill 3131, we open hearing. We'll hear more about that next week. I'll talk about that. After we include Joe, we'll probably a little more on that. Close the hearing of House Bill 3131. Meltdown Hill again.
He's going to be there. Yes, he's going to be there. Trust me, he's going to be there.
Okay, on the very back page. We open the hearing on House Bill 3205. And we close the hearing on House Bill 3205. Open hearing on House Bill 3454 and close the hearing on House Bill 3454. And we open the hearing on House Bill 2713 and close the hearing on House Bill 2713. Open the hearing on House Bill 3541. We have amendments coming. Did we finish it off? Did we make mistakes or did that? Okay. Close hearing on 3541. We did 2713 today?
Yeah.
And open hearing on House Bill 3606. And we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3606. We'll hear that next week. You want to talk about 3116? No, tap in the other two.
I'll say a few moments. Sure.
this open hearing on House Bill 3168. Representative Atkinson.
Thank you. So with this bill, we'll talk about this bill a little bit later. We've actually worked really hard to bring in three different particular Indian tribes who would be interested in helping us get this bill effective in attorney's pitch, and look forward to having a full hearing on that.
All right. Any questions for Senator Atkinson? Let's close the hearing on House Bill 3168. Open hearing on House Bill 3435. You want to say anything about that?
No.
Close the hearing on House Bill 3435. Open the hearing on House Bill 3609. Close the hearing on House Bill 3609. And no further. Having no further business for the day, we close. We adjourn for.
I'm sorry.